The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of Russian and Ukrainian history and philosophy, an Orthodox priest, and a theorist of nationalism and agrarianism. And now, here's Matt.
Okay, everyone, welcome back to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. I am Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today is September 11th, 2011. And if I hear any more of this maudlin hand-wringing over 9/11, I'm going to flip my lid. The phoniness of this bipartisan, regime-sponsored crocodile tears is really too much for me to bear. I don't have the stomach for this kind of rehearsed, cliche, phony, pseudo-profound hand-wringing over the events of 9/11. I'm not planning on saying too much about the actual occurrences. The phoniness, the absurdities of the official account have been ripped to shreds so many times that really there's not much that I can say in addition to what so many other very, very competent writers and scholars have already said. I will say that the internet has really proven its worth in this regard, because when I read some of the comments that you see on the Yahoo News and some of the other news sources that use comments, very, very few people, at least in who are commenting, buy the 9/11 story. And while, of course, they don't like to see, you know, people get killed this way, at the same time, they're being very sarcastic about the official story. And even if they believe the official story, they still condemn how it's been exploited by those in power. For the record, of course, I believe that the regime created 9/11. I believe that they needed 9/11. I believe that the regime as a whole was in a lot of trouble, remains in a lot of trouble, and they needed this event, and they needed to blame it on a group of people, of course, that are suitably obscure enough to the American population, that you could, you know, tell stories about them, and there's really no one that can respond. When I say regime, I'm being very technical. For years, I've used the word regime with a capital R to refer to power. And power in the present kind of postmodern liberal empire is a coalition of private and public sources of power and authority. The state, governments, these are only part of the equation. And in fact, as the years go on, I'm getting more and more cynical about the state in general, although there are exceptions to this, but that the state is becoming more and more irrelevant. And what really matters is media control, media spin, the manipulation of images, the manipulation of people who dominate in the community, like, you know, governors and mayors and pastors and all these other people. It's a combination of advertising and university manipulation, public and private capital working together, really informally. And that's why groups like Bilderberg and the little and the cult of Bohemian Grove and the cult up at the Idaho mansion. Herb Allen's Idaho mansion that has a very similar kind of Bohemian Grove little cult. That these are the informal methods of how public and private capital and all those in between work together and meet together and decide in some detail how they're going to spin various events. And one of the reasons that I'm so cynical about the academics is that, you know, political science is supposed to be obsessed with this kind of thing. How power comes into existence, how it's used, how do elites meet and hash out issues and stuff like that, come to a consensus, and they refuse, very explicitly in some cases, to deal with these informal institutions of power, like Bilderberg, or like Bohemian, like Skull and Bones. There are some, in terms of the official literature, there are mentions now and again, but the fact that political science, that's supposed to be absolutely centered on these kind of sources of power, that these people will not touch it, will not talk about it, and not only that, but will attack, often in the harshest terms, people like me who bring it up as a legitimate, if not the most significant, political variable in recent years. But that's what I mean by the regime. States don't matter. Politicians really don't matter, although they can be useful now and again. What really matters are the banks and the big firms and the big universities and the big foundations. And these have worked together with entertainment, television, and advertising to create a world of almost complete illusion. And I think that both empirically and ideologically, it's relatively easy to show how these groups come together and form this system of rule that I call the regime. That really is the realization of what Thomas Hobbes spoke of in the Leviathan. It is the Leviathan in its fully developed form. And 9/11 was something that the regime required. And now, 10 years later, it's something that the regime requires even more, because I think I could say without exaggeration that what little authority the regime has in its rule over the globe derives from 9/11. I think some Europeans and Asians were kind of upset that because it was an American event, the Americans were able to take advantage of it more than anybody else. But aside from that, it's really the source of regime legitimacy. And it happens that the center of the regime is in the United States, for better or for worse. I think that the United States is the true New Jerusalem for the Jews. I think Israel, as a little state out there in the Middle East, is really increasingly irrelevant. It has no real chance in the future unless they just slaughter everybody. I believe that Israel is more or less a diversion. And again, I more or less, the real purpose of Israel as a little tiny statelet is to give a real major cause, a central focus for Jewish power to come into its own in Washington, D.C., in New York, in Los Angeles. I think really it's a diversion, because truly the perverse concept of the New Zion, New Jerusalem, really is the United States, not Israel. And one of the reasons that a lot of these Hasidic rabbis, people like in the Torah Kart and Satmar and stuff like this, that they get so upset over this little tiny state in the Middle East, is that it's forced Jews as Jews to take over many important institutions, but to do so openly. And I know that Rabbi Weiss from Natura Karta has said to me many times, both in person and over the phone, that really the most irritating thing to him is that Jews have now been put in a position where they really need to just take over governments, take over the foreign policy establishment, and use their power there just to extract resources from the goyim. And Rabbi Weiss said to me that he condemns this. It's not just that Jews are public and now easy targets, but just the fact that they really aren't involved in the history of the theology anymore. What they do now and all they really care about is power and money and manipulating the goyim. Now, what I really wanted to talk about, and it might sound strange, but September 11th in the Russian calendar is the feast day of the murder of John the Baptist. It's a very important day in the Orthodox calendar, and I'm not claiming at all, so don't accuse me, but I'm not claiming here that there's this connection between 9/11 and John the Baptist, that the people who created this scenario chose 9/11 because it's on the Julian calendar, the murder of John the Baptist. I'm not saying that at all, but I am saying that in studying the politics and the theology behind Herod's killing, Herod Antipas, that is, not the initial Herod who murdered the babies and just before Christmas, or just after Christmas, I should say. It's not the same guy. It's a member of the same family, but a different man. September 11th is significant because the political and theological, eschatological implications of the killing of St. John are immense and extremely relevant to anybody who's fighting the New World Order today. And I want to say that Herod Antipas is the non-Jewish icon of the New World Order. And, you know, there's a non-Jewish element to the New World Order. There's a Jewish element to the New World Order. They generally work together. I think the latter is the senior partner. But there's so much in John the Baptist's life, and a lot has been written on this. A lot of it isn't very good because they're really frightened of the Jewish issue and what John the Baptist really was and what he was saying to the Pharisees. Now, the Pharisees, I've said this and a lot of people have said this before, they are essentially the authors of the Talmud. The Pharisees are, according to the Jewish Encyclopedia, the central focus of all rabbis. The rabbis, the rabbinate itself, derives directly from the Pharisees. That means the Talmudic tradition also derives directly from the Pharisees. So when you have groups like the Essenes, the Qumran, John the Baptist may or may not have been associated with these groups, it really doesn't make any difference. Because the fact is that the Essenes were very profound. They vehemently opposed what they saw as the secularization and materialization of the Pharisaical group, which really became a cult. And the Pharisees and that whole Talmudic mentality was completely repugnant to these people. And so, regardless of what you may think, whether John the Baptist was involved in these groups or not, it really doesn't make any difference. I'm sure he was influenced by them, but the point is more significant. The point is that there were plenty of people in the Middle East who had withdrawn, Jews, I should say, Hebrews, real Hebrews, who had withdrawn themselves from this decay, this decrepitude of the Second Temple. And the concept is that the Talmudic mentality, although of course it hadn't been written down, but the Talmudic mentality was in full swing, and this is precisely what Jesus was talking about. And when he was confronting the Pharisees, his whole world was confronting the Pharisees. He did it over and over again, and using some of the harshest language. And that's why the Christian Zionists are some of the most ridiculous, ignorant people. They don't care about Christ or the church. They care about serving the Jews only. And I've debated these people for so many years and for so long, including over the 9/11 thing, and all they care about is Jews. It's really a bizarre cult. And what really gets me angry is that they're dragging the name of Christ through the mud, and they're dragging the concept of Christianity through the mud. And so for so many people, if you're opposed to Zionism, if you're opposed to the war, if you're opposed to all the crap about 9/11, you don't like Christians because you associate this kind of weird Puritan Protestant Judaism, really, or Zionism, with that movement. And that's what really pisses me off, because it really is, it hurts Christianity because these people are now associated with it, very much in the same way that the terrorists and the crazies, the legit, real ones in the Middle East, give Islam a bad name. I'm no friend of Islam, but I also realize that there are plenty of good Muslims out there who really don't like the use of violence, even if for a worthy cause, and especially when it targets innocent people. Again, for the record, I don't believe that most of these terrorist attacks are being done by Muslims. There's nothing in it for them, since they know that every terrorist attack just gives more ammunition for Israel and the United States and the regime to attack them. So it makes no sense. Therefore, I'm fairly certain this, you know, Mossad or CIA or whatever is behind these. And the fact is that the regime, whether in New York or Tel Aviv, they require violence. They require constant violence. They need lots of innocent people to be killed because only then can the system continue its work. And all of this is very close to the mentality of John the Baptist. In fact, the more I think about it, the more seamless it is. And that John the Baptist and the kind of the more expansive, you know, the four books of the new of the, you know, the Synoptic Gospels are, you know, I think they're true. I think they're accurate. They tell the truth. They certainly had nothing to gain by writing what they wrote, certainly, under the circumstances, since it irritated both Jews and Romans. The only motive is that it's true. But they're short. These books are short. They're essays. They're designed to give a new convert a basic overall picture of what Christ was. And so the tradition, you know, the church fathers and the canons and the great saints and martyrs and monasteries, all of that fills in the gaps. The Synoptic Gospels are an outline of Christ and what he was doing and his fights and confrontations with the Pharisees. It's true as far as it goes, but it's not the sole authority on these matters. And that's very significant to the ancient church in that there was much else that needed to be brought in that did not conflict with the Gospels. But the tradition of the church deriving from the Gospels filled out these stories and ideas with much greater precision. And the classic example of that is John the Baptist. John the Baptist is a significant figure in the Synoptic Gospels, but like with everything, like with the Mother of God, and it's very laconic. It gives a basic outline of what's happening. But the fact is that John the Baptist is a highly complex figure. John the Baptist is a political figure, he's a moral figure, and he is at war with the Jewish client king of Judea, in which case we're talking here about Herod Antipas. And he's at war with the ideas and the mentality that informs the Jewish client kings of the Roman Empire, in this particular case, Judea. And this is of immense significance for us right here in 2011 and is not entirely disconnected with the regime and its manipulation of the entire 9/11 mythology. And, you know, most of the time my sources here are from Josephus. Josephus wrote in detail about John the Baptist, as did St. Eusebius. The most important, probably the most important church historian of the ancient world, and he writes in greater detail. He doesn't contradict the Bible or the New Testament story here at all, but he does add a lot of detail to it, which is very, very significant. And when you get into the political and social mentality of John the Baptist and his confrontation with the client king of Judea, so much of our, you know, the social mentality, new world order, and prophecies of what's going to happen in this age that we live in, it becomes actually very striking and worth talking about. And I also want to say that amongst Protestants, Roman Catholics, even some Orthodox, these implications of John the Baptist relative to the mentality of this sort of what was developing as the Talmudic political idea will get overlooked. And the fact is that the literature on this topic, with the exception of Josephus personally, is really pretty bad, because their sole concern is to make sure that they dance around the issue of the Talmud and Christ's real purpose in dealing with the Pharisees, so as not to even talk about the Talmudic mentality. They'll deliberately leave these blanks, and of course most people have no idea how to connect those dots, how to fill in those blanks. So we will get into this in more detail when we come back. We're going to take a break now. Hang in there.
Don't go away, because there is more on the Orthodox Nationalist. This is VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, hosted by Matt Johnson.
Okay, everyone, welcome back to the Orthodox Nationalist. Today is September 11th, 2011, and I am dealing mostly with what September 11th really is, and that is the day when the Church on the Julian calendar commemorates the killing of John the Baptist. And there are tremendous links between the New World Order and the regime in the ways that we've been using those terms and phrases with the mentality and the purpose, the mission of John the Baptist in Judea at the time of Christ. And the social mission and struggle and the revolutionary ideology of John the Baptist and his movement against the Talmudic, or the developing Talmudic mentality, among other places in the court of Herod, who is at least formally a client of Rome, yet a Jew, and very much a part of this growing Talmudic way of thinking that had almost completely secularized, twisted, distorted, rewrote, and reinterpreted the Old Testament. And it's something that Josephus talks about in some detail, in the sense that John the Baptist was building a revolutionary movement opposed to this general trend, this general point of view. Herod Antipas both feared and respected John the Baptist. The Bible record is very clear. Bible record is true. It's very commonsensical. And it matches up very much with all of the extra biblical work done on John the Baptist and the Essenes at Qumran and Herod himself. The political context of this is that Herod had married, for political reasons, the daughter of Aretas IV of Nabat. Nabat is a very strong neighbor of Judea. They were also clients of the Romans, more or less, but Aretas IV had fought the Judaic militants of that part of the world for Rome. And so the connection between Aretas and Herod is basically one of a instrumental, utilitarian, pro-Roman orientation. And yet you had Jewish revolutionaries of different stripes that were growing in strength. Now, Herod had divorced the daughter of Aretas and married another woman, and that was a stupid political move on the one hand, and was an immoral, if not just straight out amoral, thing to do domestically. And a lot of people were very offended by this, and that this guy would just, you know, get rid of women on a whim, not to mention the fact that it just irritated Adatas IV. And Herod had lost a border war with Adatas over this issue, or at least it was facilitated by this issue. So John the Baptist is confronting Herod over these and many other issues. On the one hand, Herod is more or less convinced that John is right and that he's done a very stupid thing. But on the other hand, he's also noticing that St. John the Baptist is building a resistance movement within Judea. And this resistance movement exclusively derives from the Old Testament prophetic tradition. We've dealt with that on this show, the political and ethical and economic point of view of the prophets almost perfectly fits in this, you know, basic idea of social nationalism, a nationalism that takes the economic condition of labor very, very seriously. Something Rousseauian, something centering around this general will that unifies all the disparate elements of a population and creates a nation. It makes explicit those commonalities that these people have for the sake of creating social unity. And when you read the prophets, I have a show on talk on the prophets that I did some time ago. Listen to it if you haven't already, because the point is that these were highly political and economic writers. And they had a very cohesive, coherent agenda as to what the politics and economics of Israel, in the true sense of the word, is to be. Christ didn't need to talk at length about political science, because he assumed that everyone knew about the prophets. He was behaving very much like a prophet. He had no reason to repeat yet again the political and social agenda of the prophets that he clearly agreed with, especially since John the Baptist was doing it anyway. But the prophetic message in terms of monarchy was that the monarchy does not rule the people. The monarchy is a military leader, and more importantly, is a moral example to the population. He is a part of the population. He is the mere representative of the law, of logos. And we talked about this at length, and we'll continue to talk about how significant the idea of logos, or the essence of natural law, is, not just in science, but also in politics and in the way, you know, psychology, the way we live. Again, nothing that Josephus says here opposes the gospel story. There's certainly nothing wrong with it. It makes perfect sense given what we know about Herod. But he does add a lot of detail. He had a broader agenda. He saw Christ as really the ultimate expression of this broader agenda. And the one thing that John and Jesus had in common was that they were the final end. This was it in terms of the prophetic message. They had brought it to perfection. But, of course, they also assumed that their readers at the time, or their hearers, I should say, at the time, and their readers a little bit later, are going to be fully aware of the prophetic tradition. It was part of the folk memory of the people. And, of course, in our alienated age, no one knows a thing about it. And that's why Christ appears so strange. These short little aphorisms and stories. But forgetting, you know, he's assuming that his readers are aware, on the one hand, of what the prophetic message was, and on the other hand, how far Israel had departed from it. That's the whole point of the prophets in the first place. They did nothing other than condemn Israel. Israel had forgotten who they were. They had abandoned God. They worshiped themselves. And ultimately, that means that they worship money and power and political gain. And they view these things as ends in themselves. And that's why John is so significant. And that's why John the Baptist really is an icon of the church in the last days. St. John the Baptist is a prophet and a nationalist. Like all of the prophets They were very ethnic. They were very national in their point of view. But the developing ethnic idea of Israel wasn't so much racial in the sense that it was about genetics and passing down of racial traits. It was about the faith. Anyone can be an Israelite in the true sense of the word if they converted. And that's the case today. Anyone can be an Israelite, referring to a member of the Orthodox Church, if they convert. It doesn't matter what their background is. The ethnic and racial idea of Israel, of Orthodoxy, is about faith and about making that faith part of you. In terms of blood, we need to remember that the real presence of the Eucharist means that Christ is present at the altar, at every liturgy, and when we receive that, that blood becomes our blood. And so all Orthodox people, regardless of their particular ethnic background, have the same blood running through their veins. And the fact that Christ made very clear, and all the church fathers made very clear, that this really is Christ present, the full manifestation, not just a partial manifestation that we see in Logos in the natural world, but the full manifestation of Christ as Logos in nature, nature being symbolized by bread and wine at the altar. So the blood flowing through our veins is one and the same. And that's always this rejection against this kind of vulgar 19th century materialism that holds race as DNA as the main reality. That has relevance in terms of social ideas and the development of our states and way of life. That has nothing to do with theology. For theology, there is only one blood that matters, and that's the blood of Jesus Christ that we receive at the altar. But that doesn't mean that the prophets and St. John and Christ were not nationalists in that sense. There was one faith, there was one truth. And as European history developed, that one faith and one truth became concentrated in the people of Russia, speaking broadly, Moscow, Kiev, Minsk, Belgrade, Sofia, and elsewhere, but overwhelmingly dominated by Slavic peoples. There's nothing special about the Slavic peoples, except that for whatever reason, God has chosen them as his particular messengers, in the same way that he chose the peoples of ancient Mesopotamia to become Israel. The ethnic racial connections in the 19th century sense don't concern me. They may be significant, and you could write about it. I don't care. The more significant part is the faith and what you accept and how that blood becomes a part of you. So in that particular cultural, theological, ethnic sense, rather than a strictly racial sense, does the nationalism of the prophets become clearer and clearer. Now, the big issues here is that St. John was protesting against the domination of the Talmudic mentality amongst the Pharisees and against monarchs like Herod. That material racial worship of Jews as Jews, that they're saved by their DNA, they're saved by their race. All of this is kind of material worship of power, dead matter, money. This is the protest of John the Baptist. And in order to do this, he must purify himself through a very intense regimen of what we call today monastic living. He was an anchorite. He was a hermit. He was an intense ascetic. And that means that the political reform of the people of Israel, in the true legitimate sense of the word, has to do with our internal reform. We can't reform what's outside of us before we reform what's inside of us. And that's one of the things that separates the revolutionary thinking of John the Baptist from the revolutionary thinking of Jews, or I really should say the Khazar Talmudists in later centuries, in that they never had any internal reform. They certainly were not ascetics. They believed that revolution was a sure way for them to come to power. Herod, because of all of this, had John followed. He had John tailed by Jews who were sympathetic to him and made certain that what John was saying and preaching, which, of course, he always said out in the open. He never had a secret agenda. Everything was out in the open, and they reported back to Herod. Since marriages are political, the divorce of his first wife, who was a daughter of the Nabatean king, was a big deal. So when John condemns Herod for that, and John, of course, accuses him of not only the amoral basis of this, but the fact that lust cannot control how we approach things that are political, whether the lust for power or the lust for women, it doesn't make any difference. Really, it's all the same vice. And this is why John was so adamant about purifying himself through fasting and long vigil and a very sparse diet. Living out in the desert, he wanted to purify himself internally and permit more and more oxygen to go to his brain so he could think more and more clearly. So he's acting as sort of an icon of what the church is supposed to be. This is what the church is supposed to do. And then confront the powers that be with our counterexample. And it's not uncommon in monastic literature to see the ascetic life as a protest against the materialism of the regime, whether it be then or now. Really, I mean, while we might have all of these scientific theories that are supposed to impress us, it doesn't matter. We might know more about the sin, we might know more about the chemistry behind it, but it doesn't alter the moral status of this. When lust and other passions take over, we don't think straight. Only through asceticism, only through this interior reform, can we think properly. One of the reasons that the Pharisees really hated John, and of course Jesus after him, was that like all the prophets, John never condemned Rome. And of course, the prophets of the Old Testament, Rome could be Babylonia, Egypt, or Assyria. It didn't matter. John never condemned Rome. John condemned Israel because it, not necessarily Rome, was falling apart. It was immoral. It was beginning to be what we know today as Talmudic. The Jews who were following the Pharisees and Herod in that whole basic mentality, these were Antichrist. Antichrist in the true eternal sense of the word. Rome is a diversion. What's happening is that all of these revolutionaries are deflecting attention from the intense moral decay of the Jews by claiming that Rome is this terrible oppressor. Herod is in a very strange position because he is both a client of Rome and also a Jew. So his views of John the Baptist are going to be equally schizophrenic. Herod represents Antichrist in that he is what we would call today a Talmudist. He worships money and political power. And he is also connected with the state that has at least a majority of Gentiles running it, but Jewish influence is very, very powerful within it. So John is an icon of the church. Herod is the icon of Antichrist. St. John viewed the Second Temple as defiled because of the evil of the Pharisees, the materialism of the Pharisees. Jesus will say the same thing when he goes into the temple and begins beating them with a whip. And for John, in order to purify himself from the demons that were running the temple, he needed to go into isolation. And because he had a direct connection to God rather than mediated through the Pharisees, he was baptizing people as a way to cleanse the filth of the world, the Pharisees, and that materialist mentality from them. John says that the Pharisees are Antichrist. They have long abandoned the Old Testament. They've long abandoned the law. They've long abandoned the prophets. their veneration of the law is for public consumption. Like law today, it really has nothing to do with organizing how we live and make it rational and peaceful. It's about how people can manipulate the law for their own purposes. This connection between Herod and the Roman Empire, this connection between Jews and the state, Jews and power, Jews and materialism, this is Antichrist. This is that pagan materialism that will be represented by these elite Jews, typified by Herod. This will be the very apogee of the Antichrist mentality. Herod is the very symbol of the Talmud. But at the same time, violent revolution isn't the answer unless we are internally cleansed and radically reformed. Because if we're not reformed, then we have no place to stand when we condemn others. And certainly Jesus and John the Baptist and all the prophets, they did nothing but condemn. They did absolutely nothing but condemn those who had departed from the tradition, from the prophets, and from the vision of justice, of divine justice in this case, that the prophets put out there. The community of the church, whether it be the Old Testament prophetic vision or the New Testament vision of the Orthodox Church as the New Jerusalem, the New Zion, it is one. God is one. There is one truth. There is one church. There is one unity. We may be separated in terms of function and part of the world and language, but that's totally insignificant. We're one because we have a singular faith, and therefore we treat each other like brothers. We treat each other as we would ourselves, and we sacrifice anything and everything for them. The ideas of, you know, turn the other cheek and you know, the rejection of, you know, all of these things have to do with the unity of the church. We're under no obligation to turn the other cheek for the enemies of the church, those outside of it who seek to destroy us. If that were true, then the entire Byzantine Empire would be completely illegitimate. The Byzantine Empire was a Greek Orthodox militarized society. Internally, justice had to reign. Externally, the army needs to be used against any organized threat to the state, to the church, and to the unity between the two. So we're talking about a reform of the chosen people, whether it be the ancient Israelites, the modern Orthodox people. It's one and the same thing, one and the same group. The Talmudic Khazars are Lucifer's chosen people. And their predecessor is not just the Pharisees, but also people like Herod. They went back and forth their relationships with one another. But it doesn't matter. Even if they were enemies, it doesn't matter. The mentality is still exactly the same. Power exists for its own sake. At least in Herod, you see Herod wavering back and forth. John is relentless in his attacking of Herod. John clearly has a following. Herod is worried about the force necessary to control this following. But what John is talking about is really a religious anarchist community based on the single general will, and that general will, using in the Rousseauian phrase, is the will of God, manifest in the community, and that is itself, so to speak, the incarnation of justice. At the same time, there is a prophecy of what was later to become the sexual revolution, because ultimately, despite all of these significant political factors, the issues are still here today. They haven't changed in their essentials. City of God, city of man, one is a divine manifestation, the other is a Luciferian manifestation. The sexual revolution And I know E. Michael Jones has written, you know, several thousand pages on this, showing directly from the Rockefeller archives how the creation of the sexual revolution will be used to control people. The Rockefeller Foundation, when they created this, when they financed the early feminists and they financed all of these groups to destroy the family and to liberate sex and different kind, you know, homosexuality and everything else from its previous very, very tightly controlled nature, the point is to create a very different type of control. And this is exactly what happens here with John the Baptist. The only reason that Herod has to murder John, a man that, yeah, it's true he fears him, but he also respects him. He respects him because John is not afraid to simply get right in his face and confront him and condemn him. Herod is a type that respects that kind of directness as compared to all of those who flatter him for the sake of some kind of favor. But Herod's new wife's daughter is apparently extremely attractive, and she begins to dance in what we would call today like in a go-go style, in the way so that Herod could then come under her spell. It's no accident that in the ancient world and in the Middle Ages, she becomes the icon for witches. Witches, not in some mystic sense that they have magical powers, really only refer to the, really, they refer to materialism. It refers to the manipulation of matter. And in this case, Herodias is using her body and her appearance to manipulate, quite literally, the body chemistry of Herod. I mean, this is really what magic is in this particular case. There's nothing mystical about it. It is strict materialism. And in this case, it is the use of her body to manipulate the chemistry of Herod. Because Herod's new illegitimate wife is extremely upset over what John the Baptist is saying, the scam is to use this sort of sex magic, and I mean that literally, sex magic, to bring Herod under her control. And then Herod, in his hormonal stupor, which, by the way, he's drunk at the same time, so this man isn't thinking straight, he then says to Herodias, I'll give you whatever you want. I mean, this is, you know, men know all about this. You get into a certain state and you tell the woman, and I'll give you the moon, but it isn't you. It isn't reason. It is hormones. It is chemistry. And this is what the sexual revolution is based on. The manipulation of men. It is a continuation of the killing of the king ritual. It is the use of sex to reduce men to Play-Doh, to clay, to something that you can very easily manipulate for your own purposes. Sex is a weapon. It has always been a weapon. And it is proven by the fact that the Bible story could not be clearer here. Sex is used as a weapon to get Herod to say something that he really doesn't mean. And under normal circumstances, he would never say. And so then Herodias, because she's under orders from her mother, says, I want John's head on a plate, and I want that plate right here at the banquet, at the party. And everyone's drunk, and everyone, so this is why John gets murdered. So we have this, you know, brilliantly laid out, and it's brilliant not only because of what it integrates, but it only does so in a few paragraphs. You know, I'm sorry, if the apostles didn't write this, then who the heck did? This is first-class political writing. Because political power, political agendas, our own lusts and passions, the manipulation of those vices and passions for the sake of some political end, all of which resolves itself in the battle against, in this case, John the Baptist's revolutionary agenda, which will become later on central agenda of Orthodox monasticism and our own ethical and political agenda against what we call today the New World Order. Herod is the New World Order, or even more so, the Pharisees are the New World Order. Herod is at least wavering, and it shows you that he has some honesty. And so, because of this integration, so much of the Orthodox concept of monasticism has come into existence. And ultimately, it is the female body, not problematic in and of itself, but problematic only when it becomes connected to this agenda. The sexual revolution was about one thing. It was about the use of the female body to control men, and the result of which is a complete remaking of society, whether it be sexual mores or the family or ease of divorce or abortion. And it should be noted that Herod, the member of the of that line, who was alive when Christ was a baby, becomes the patron saint of abortion because he kills who knows how many hundreds of little kids solely because he fears Christ. And abortion is all about that. It's about maintaining power. It's about maintaining money and getting more money, being free, so to speak. But the fact is, freedom never has anything to do with your passions. Passions will enslave you, and that's proven by this story. Men promising, powerful men, promising all of these things because Herod is partying, because he's probably drunk, but more than that, this woman, Herodias, has used her gifts for the sake of manipulating this man. This sort of thing, of course, continues today, and it's at the very root of the manipulation of the New World Order. So, I appreciate you guys listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. Time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Tuned in to